own? No. How extraordinary. And how does Monsieur de Villefort bear it, as usual, like a philosopher? Danglars returned at this moment alone.
Well, said the Countess, do you leave Monsieur Cavalcanti with your daughter?
And Mademoiselle d'Army, said the banker. Do you consider her no one?
Then turning to Monte Cristo, he said,
Prince Cavalcanti is a charming young man, is he not? But is he really a prince?
I will not answer for it, said Monte Cristo. His father was introduced to me as a marquis, so he ought to be a count, but I do not think he has much claim to that title.
Why, said the banker, if he is a prince, he is wrong not to maintain his rank. I do not like anyone to deny his origin.
Oh, you are a pure democrat, said Monte Cristo, smiling. But do you see to what you are exposing yourself? If, perchance, Monsieur de Morcerf came, he would find Monsieur Cavalcanti in that room, where he, the betrothed of Eugénie, has never been admitted.
You may well say, perchance, replied the banker, for he comes so seldom, it would seem only chance that brings him.
But should he come, and find that young man with your daughter, he might be displeased.
He? You are mistaken. Monsieur Albert would not do us the honour to be jealous. He does not like Eugénie sufficiently. Besides, I care not for his displeasure.
The valet announced Monsieur le Vicomte Albert de Morcerf. The Countess rose hastily and was going into the study when Danglars stopped her.
Stay, said he.
She looked at him in amazement. Monte Cristo appeared to be unconscious of what passed. Albert entered looking very handsome and in high spirits. He bowed politely to the Countess, familiarly to Danglars, and affectionately to Monte Cristo. Then, turning to the Countess, "May I ask how Mademoiselle Danglars is?" said he.
"She is quite well," replied Danglars quickly. "She is at the piano with Monsieur Cavalcanti."
Albert preserved his calm and indifferent manner. He might feel perhaps annoyed, but he knew Monte Cristo's eye was on him. "Monsieur Cavalcanti has a fine tenor voice," said he, "and Mademoiselle Eugénie a splendid soprano. And then she plays on the piano like Thalberg. The concert must be a delightful one."
"They suit each other remarkably well," said Danglars.
Albert appeared not to notice this remark, which was, however, so rude that Madame Danglars blushed. "I, too," said the young man, "am a musician. At least, my masters used to tell me so. But it is strange that my voice never would suit any other, and a soprano less than any." Danglars smiled, and seemed to say, "It is of no consequence." Then, hoping doubtless to effect his purpose, he said,
"The prince and my daughter were universally admired yesterday. You were not of the party, Monsieur de Morcerf."
"What prince?" asked Albert.
"Prince Cavalcanti," said Danglars, who persisted in giving the young man that title.
"Pardon me," said Albert. "I was not aware he was a prince." "And Prince Cavalcanti sang with Mademoiselle Eugénie yesterday? It must have been charming, indeed. I regret not having heard them, but I was unable to accept your invitation, having promised to accompany my mother to a German concert given by the Countess of Château Renaud." This was followed by rather an awkward silence. "May I also be allowed," said Morcerf, "to pay my respects to Mademoiselle Danglars?"
"Wait a moment," said the banker, stopping the young man. "Do you hear that delightful cavatina? Ta-ta-ta-ti-ta-ti-ta. It is charming. Let them finish. One moment. Bravo! Bravi! Brava!" The banker was enthusiastic in his applause. "Indeed," said Albert. "It is exquisite. It is impossible to understand the music of his country better than Prince Cavalcanti does. You said prince, did you not? But he can easily become one if he is not already. It is no uncommon thing in Italy. But to return to the charming musicians, you should give us a treat, Danglars, without telling them there is a stranger. Ask them to sing one more song. It is so delightful to hear music in the distance when the musicians are unrestrained by observation."
Danglars was quite annoyed by the young man's indifference. He took Monte Cristo aside.
"What do you think of our lover?" said he.
"He appears cool, but then your word is given."
"Yes, doubtless. I have promised to give my daughter to a man who loves her, but not to one who does not. Even if Albert had Cavalcanti's fortune, he is so proud, I would not care to see him marry her."
"Oh," said Monte Cristo, "my fondness may blind me, but I assure you I consider Morcerf far preferable, and his father's position is good."
Said Danglars. "Why do you doubt? The past, that obscurity on the past, but that does not affect the son. A month since, you thought well of him, and I know nothing of young Cavalcanti, although you met him at my house." "But I do. Have you made inquiry?" "Yes, and I know him to be rich."
"What do you suppose him worth?"
50,000 per annum, and he is well educated."
Said Monte Cristo in his turn. "He is a musician. So are all Italians.
Come, Count, you do not do that young man justice."
"Well, I acknowledge it annoys me, knowing your connection with the Morcerf family, to see him throw himself in the way."
Danglars burst out laughing. "What a Puritan you are," said he. "That happens every day."
"But you cannot break it off thus. The Morcerfs are depending on this union."
"Indeed,
positively."
"Then let them explain themselves. You should give the father a hint, you who are so intimate with the family."
"I? Where the devil did you find out that?"
"At their ball. It was apparent enough. Why did not the Countess, the proud Mercedes, the disdainful Catalane, who will scarcely open her lips to her oldest acquaintances, take your arm, lead you into the garden, into the private walks, and remain there for half an hour? But will you undertake to speak to the father?"
"Willingly, if you wish it.
But let it be done explicitly and positively. If he demands my daughter, let him fix the day, declare his conditions. In short, let us either understand each other or quarrel. You understand? No more delay."
"Yes, sir. I will give my attention to the subject."
"I do not say I expect him with pleasure, but I do expect him. A banker must, you know, be a slave to his promise."
And Danglars sighed, as Monsieur Cavalcanti had done half an hour before.
"Bravo!" cried Morcerf, as the scene closed. Danglars began to look suspiciously at Morcerf when someone came and whispered a few words to him.
"I shall soon return," said the banker to Monte Cristo. "Wait for me. I shall perhaps have something to say to you."
The Baroness took advantage of her husband's absence to push open the door of her daughter's study, and Monsieur Andrea, who was sitting before the piano with Mademoiselle Eugénie, started up like a spring. Albert bowed to Mademoiselle Danglars with a smile, who, not appearing in the least disturbed, returned his bow with her usual coolness. Cavalcanti was evidently embarrassed. He bowed to Morcerf, who replied with the most impertinent look possible. Then Albert launched out in praise of Mademoiselle Danglars' voice, and on his regret, after what he had just heard, he had been unable to be present the previous evening. Cavalcanti, being left alone, turned to Monte Cristo.
"Come," said Madame Danglars, "leave music and compliments, and let us go and take tea."
"Come, Louisa," said Mademoiselle Danglars to her friend.
They passed into the next drawing-room, where tea was prepared. Just as they were beginning in the English fashion to leave the spoon in their cups, the door again opened, and Danglars entered, visibly agitated. Monte Cristo observed it particularly, and, by a look, asked the banker for an explanation.
"I have just received my courier from Greece," said Danglars.
"Ah," said the Count, "that was the reason of your running away from us."
"Yes."
"How is King Otto?"
asked Albert, in the most sprightly tone. Danglars cast another suspicious look towards him without answering, and Monte Cristo turned away to conceal the expression of pity which passed over his features, but which was gone in a moment.
"We shall go together, shall we not?" said Albert to the Count.
"If you like," replied the latter. Albert could not understand the banker's look, and turning to Monte Cristo, who understood it perfectly,
"Did you see," said he, "how he looked at me?"
"Yes," said the Count, "but did you think there was anything particular in his look?"
"Indeed I did. And what does he mean by his news from Greece?"
"How can I tell you? Because I imagine you have correspondence in that country." Monte Cristo smiled significantly.
"Stop," said Albert, "here he comes. I shall compliment Mademoiselle Danglars on her cameo while the father talks to you."
Albert advanced towards Eugénie, smiling, while Danglars, stooping to Monte Cristo's ear,
"Your advice was excellent," said he. "There is a whole history connected with the names Fernand and Janina."
"Indeed," said Monte Cristo.
"Yes, I will tell you all. But take away the young man. I cannot endure his presence."
"He is going with me. Shall I send the father to you?"
"Immediately."
"Very well."
The Count made a sign to Albert. They bowed to the ladies and took their leave. Albert, perfectly indifferent to Mademoiselle Danglars' contempt, Monte Cristo reiterating his advice to Madame Danglars on the prudence a banker's wife should exercise in providing for the future. Monsieur Cavalcanti remained master of the field. 78. A-Day. Scarcely had the Count's horses cleared the angle of the boulevard than Albert, turning towards the Count, burst into a loud fit of laughter, much too loud, in fact, not to give the idea of its being rather forced and unnatural.
"Well," said he, "how have I played my little part?"
"To what do you allude?" asked Monte Cristo.
"To the installation of my rival at Monsieur Danglars'."
"What rival?"
"Ma foi, what rival! Why, your protégé, Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti."
"Ah, no joking, Viscount, if you please. I do not patronize Monsieur Andrea, at least not as concerns Monsieur Danglars, and you would be to blame for not assisting him if the young man really needed your help in that quarter. But, happily for me, he can dispense with it."
"What? Do you think he is paying his addresses? I am certain of it. His languishing looks and modulated tones when addressing Mademoiselle Danglars fully proclaim his intentions. He aspires to the hand of the proud Eugénie."
"What does that signify, so long as they favor your suit?"
"But it is not the case, my dear Count. On the contrary, I am repulsed on all sides."
"What? It is so, indeed. Mademoiselle Eugénie scarcely answers me, and Mademoiselle D'Army, her confidante, does not speak to me at all."
"But the father has the greatest regard possible for you," said Monte Cristo.
"He? Oh, no. He has plunged 1,000 daggers into my heart. Tragedy weapons, I own, which, instead of wounding, sheathe their points in their own handles, but daggers which he nevertheless believed to be real and deadly. Jealousy indicates affection."
"True. But I am not jealous."
"He is."
"Of whom?" "'Of Debray? No. Of you. Of me. I will engage to say that before a week is past, the door will be closed against me. You are mistaken, my dear Viscount. Prove it to me. Do you wish me to do so? Yes. Well, I am charged with the commission of endeavouring to induce Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf to make some definite arrangement with the Baron. By whom are you charged? By the Baron himself.
Oh, said Albert, with all the cajolery of which he was capable, you surely will not do that, my dear Count.
Certainly I shall, Albert, as I have promised to do it.
Well, said Albert with a sigh, it seems you are determined to marry me.
I am determined to try and be on good terms with everybody at all events, said Monte Cristo. But apropos of Debray, how is it that I have not seen him lately at the Baron's house? There has been a misunderstanding.
What, with the Baroness?
No, with the Baron. Has he perceived anything?
Ha! That is a good joke. Do you think he suspects? Said Monte Cristo, with a charming naivete.
Where have you come from, my dear Count? Said Albert.
From Congo, if you will. It must be farther off than even that. But what do I know of your Parisian husbands?
Oh, my dear Count, husbands are pretty much the same everywhere. An individual husband of any country is a pretty fair specimen of the whole race.
But then, what can have led to the quarrel between Danglars and Debray? They seemed to understand each other so well, said Monte Cristo with renewed energy.
Ah, now you are trying to penetrate into the mysteries of Isis, in which I am not initiated. When Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti has become one of the family, you can ask him that question.
The carriage stopped.
Here we are, said Monte Cristo. It is only 10:30. Come in.
Certainly I will.
My carriage shall take you back. No, thank you. I gave orders for my coupe to follow me.
There it is, then, said Monte Cristo, as he stepped out of the carriage.
They both went into the house. The drawing room was lighted up. They entered it.
You will make tea for us, Baptistin, said the Count.
Baptistin left the room without waiting to answer, and in 2 seconds reappeared, bringing on a waiter all that his master had ordered ready prepared, and appearing to have sprung from the ground, like the repasts which we read of in fairy tales.
Really, my dear Count, said Morcerf, what I admire in you is not so much your riches, for perhaps there are people even wealthier than yourself, nor is it only your wit, for Beaumarchais might have possessed as much, but it is your manner of being served without any questions, in a moment, in a second. It is as if they guessed what you wanted by your manner of ringing, and made a point of keeping everything you can possibly desire in constant readiness.
Ah, but what do I hear? And Morcerf inclined his head towards the door, through which sounds seemed to issue resembling those of a guitar.
Ma foi, my dear Viscount, you are fated to hear music this evening. You have only escaped from the piano of Mademoiselle Danglars to be attacked by the guzla of Aide.
Aide? What an adorable name! Are there, then, really women who bear the name of Aide anywhere but in Byron's poems?
Certainly there are.
Aide is a very uncommon name in France, but it is common enough in Albania and Epirus. It is as if you said, for example, chastity, modesty, innocence. It is a kind of baptismal name, as you Parisians call it.
Oh, that is charming, said Albert. How I should like to hear my countrywomen called Mademoiselle Goodness, Mademoiselle Silence, Mademoiselle Christian Charity. Only think, then, if Mademoiselle Danglars, instead of being called Claire Marie Eugénie, had been named Mademoiselle Chastity Modesty Innocence Danglars, what a fine effect that would have produced on the announcement of her marriage.
Silence, said the Count.
Do not joke in so loud a tone. Ada may hear you, perhaps. And you think she would be angry? No, certainly not, said the Count, with a haughty expression. She is very amiable, then, is she not? Said Albert. It is not to be called amiability. It is her duty. A slave does not dictate to a master. Come, you are joking yourself now. Are there any more slaves to be had who bear this beautiful name? Undoubtedly. Really, Count, you do nothing and have nothing like other people. The slave of Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo, why, it is a rank of itself in France, and from the way in which you lavish money, it is a place that must be worth 100,000 francs a year. 100,000 francs. The poor girl originally possessed much more than that. She was born to treasures, in comparison with which those recorded in the 1,001 Nights would seem but poverty. She must be a princess, then. You are right. And she is one of the greatest in her country, too. I thought so. But how did it happen that such a great princess became a slave? How was it that Dionysius the tyrant became a schoolmaster? The fortune of war, my dear Viscount, the caprice of fortune. That is the way in which these things are to be accounted for. And is her name a secret? As regards the generality of mankind, it is. But not for you, my dear Viscount, who are one of my most intimate friends, and on whose silence I feel I may rely, if I consider it necessary to enjoin it. May I not do so? Certainly. On my word of honour. You know the history of Pasha of Yanina, do you not? Of Ali Tebelin? Oh, yes. It was in his service that my father made his fortune. True. I had forgotten that. Well, what is Ada to Ali Tebelin?
Merely his daughter.
What? The daughter of Ali Pasha?
Of Ali Pasha and the beautiful Vasiliki.
And your slave?
Ma foi, yes.
But how did she become so?
Why, simply from the circumstance of my having bought her one day, as I was passing through the market at Constantinople.
Wonderful! Really, my dear Count, you seem to throw a sort of magic influence over all in which you are concerned. When listening to you, existence no longer seems reality but a waking dream. Now, I am perhaps going to make an imprudent and thoughtless request, but...
Say on.
But since you go out with Ada and sometimes even take her to the opera...
Well, I think I may venture to ask you this favour.
You may venture to ask me anything.
Well then, my dear Count, present me to your princess.
I will do so, but on two conditions. I accept them at once. The first is that you will never tell anyone that I have granted the interview.
Very well, said Albert, extending his hand. I swear I will not.
The second is that you will not tell her that your father ever served hers.
I give you my oath that I will not.
Enough, Viscount. You will remember these two vows, will you not? But I know you to be a man of honour.
The Count again struck the gong. Ali reappeared.
Tell Ada, said he, that I will take coffee with her, and give her to understand that I desire permission to present one of my friends to her.
Ali bowed and left the room.
Now, understand me, said the Count. No direct questions, my dear Morcerf. If you wish to know anything, tell me, and I will ask her.
Agreed.
Ali reappeared for the third time, and drew back the tapestried hanging which concealed the door, to signify to his master and Albert that they were at liberty to pass on.
Let us go in, said Monte Cristo.
Albert passed his hand through his hair and curled his moustache, then, having satisfied himself as to his personal appearance, followed the Count into the room, the latter having previously resumed his hat and gloves. Ali was stationed as a kind of advanced guard, and the door was kept by the three French femmes de chambre, commanded by Myrtot.
Haydée was awaiting her visitors in the first room of her suite of apartments, which was the drawing room. Her large eyes were dilated with surprise and expectation, for it was the first time that any man except Monte Cristo had been accorded an entrance into her presence. She was sitting on a sofa placed in an angle of the room, with her legs crossed under her in the Eastern fashion, and seemed to have made for herself, as it were, a kind of nest in the rich Indian silks which enveloped her. Near her was the instrument on which she had just been playing. It was elegantly fashioned and worthy of its mistress. On perceiving Monte Cristo, she rose and welcomed him with a kind of smile peculiar to herself, expressive at once of the most implicit obedience and also of the deepest love. Monte Cristo advanced towards her and extended his hand, which she, as usual, raised to her lips. Albert had proceeded no farther than the door, where he remained rooted to the spot, being completely fascinated by the sight of such surpassing beauty, beheld, as it was, for the first time, and of which an inhabitant of more northern climates could form no adequate idea. "Whom do you bring?" asked the young girl, in Romaic, of Monte Cristo. "Is it a friend, a brother, a simple acquaintance, or an enemy?" "A friend," said Monte Cristo, in the same language. "What is his name?" "Count Albert. It is the same man whom I rescued from the hands of the banditti at Rome. In what language would you like me to converse with him?" Monte Cristo turned to Albert. "Do you know modern Greek?" asked he. "Alas, no," said Albert, "nor even ancient Greek, my dear Count. Never had Homer or Plato a more unworthy scholar than myself." "Then," said Haydée, proving by her remark that she had quite understood Monte Cristo's question and Albert's answer, "then I will speak either in French or Italian, if my lord so wills it." Monte Cristo reflected one instant. "You will speak in Italian," said he. Then turning towards Albert, "It is a pity you do not understand either ancient or modern Greek, both of which Haydée speaks so fluently. The poor child will be obliged to talk to you in Italian, which will give you but a very false idea of her powers of conversation." The Count made a sign to Haydée to address his visitor. "Sir," said she to Morcerf, "you are most welcome as the friend of my lord and master." This was said in excellent Tuscan, and with that soft Roman accent which makes the language of Dante as sonorous as that of Homer. Then, turning to Ali, she directed him to bring coffee and pipes, and when he had left the room to execute the orders of his young mistress, she beckoned Albert to approach nearer to her. Monte Cristo and Morcerf drew their seats towards a small table, on which were arranged music, drawings, and vases of flowers. Ali then entered, bringing coffee and chibouques. As to Monsieur Battistin, this portion of the building was interdicted to him. Albert refused the pipe which the Nubian offered him. "Oh, take it, take it," said the Count. "Haydée is almost as civilized as a Parisian. The smell of an Havana is disagreeable to her, but the tobacco of the East is a most delicious perfume, you know." Ali left the room. The cups of coffee were all prepared, with the addition of a sugar glass, which had been brought for Albert. Monte Cristo and Haydée took the liquor in the original Arabian manner, that is to say, without sugar. Haydée took the porcelain cup in her little slender fingers and conveyed it to her mouth with all the innocent naivete of a child when eating or drinking something which it likes. At this moment two women entered, bringing salvers filled with ices and sherbet, which they placed on two small tables appropriated to that purpose. "My dear host, and you, signora," said Albert in Italian, "excuse my apparent stupidity. I am quite bewildered, and it is natural that it should be so. Here I am in the heart of Paris. But a moment ago I heard the rumbling of the omnibuses and the tinkling of the bells of the lemonade sellers, and now I feel as if I were suddenly transported to the East, not such as I have seen it, but such as my dreams have painted it. Oh, Signora, if I could but speak Greek, your conversation, added to the fairy scene which surrounds me, would furnish an evening of such delight as it would be impossible for me ever to forget. I speak sufficient Italian to enable me to converse with you, sir, said Ade quietly, and if you like what is Eastern, I will do my best to secure the gratification of your tastes while you are here. On what subject shall I converse with her? Said Albert in a low tone to Monte Cristo. Just what you please. You may speak of her country and of her youthful reminiscences, or, if you like it better, you can talk of Rome, Naples, or Florence.
Oh, said Albert, it is of no use to be in the company of a Greek if one converses just in the same style as with a Parisian. Let me speak to her of the East. Do so, then, for of all themes which you could choose, that will be the most agreeable to her taste. Albert turned towards Ade. At what age did you leave Greece, Signora? Asked he.
I left it when I was but 5 years old, replied Ade.
And have you any recollections of your country?
When I shut my eyes and think, I seem to see it all again. The mind has its organ of vision as well as the body, with this additional perfection, that the objects presented to its view are indelibly impressed.
And how far back into the past do your recollections extend?
I could scarcely walk when my mother, who was called Vasiliki, which means royal, said the young girl, tossing her head proudly, took me by the hand, and after putting in our purse all the money we possessed, we went out, both covered with veils, to solicit alms for the prisoners, saying, He who giveth to the poor lendeth to the Lord. Then, when our purse was full, we returned to the palace, and without saying a word to my father, we sent it to the convent, where it was divided amongst the prisoners.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 3 years old, said Ade.
Then you remember all which was passing around you when you were but 3 years old, said Albert.
All.
Count, said Albert in a low tone to Monte Cristo, do allow the Signora to tell me something of her history. You prohibited my mentioning my father's name to her, but perhaps she will allude to him of her own accord in the course of the recital, and you have no idea how delighted I should be to hear our name pronounced by such beautiful lips.
Monte Cristo turned to Ade, and with an expression of countenance which commanded her to pay the most implicit attention to his words, he said in Greek, Tell us the fate of your father, but neither the name of the traitor nor the treason. Ade sighed deeply, and a shade of sadness clouded her beautiful brow.
What are you saying to her? Said Morcerf in an undertone.
I again reminded her that you were a friend, and that she need not conceal anything from you.
Then, said Albert, this pious pilgrimage in behalf of the prisoners was your first remembrance. What is the next?
Oh, then I remember, as if it were but yesterday, sitting under the shade of some sycamore trees on the borders of a lake, in the waters of which the trembling foliage was reflected as in a mirror. Under the oldest and thickest of these trees, reclining on cushions, sat my father. My mother was at his feet, and I, childlike, amused myself by playing with his long white beard, which descended to his waist, or with the diamond hilt of the scimitar attached to his girdle. Then, from time to time, there came to him an Albanian who said something to which I paid no attention, but which he always answered in the same tone of voice, either kill or pardon.
"'It is very strange,' said Albert, "'to hear such words proceed from the mouth of anyone but an actress on the stage, "'and one needs constantly to be saying to oneself, "'This is no fiction, it is all reality, in order to believe it. "'And how does France appear in your eyes, "'accustomed as they have been to gaze on such enchanted scenes?'
"'I think it is a fine country,' said Aidé, "'but I see France as it really is, "'because I look on it with the eyes of a woman, "'whereas my own country, which I can only judge of "'from the impression produced on my childish mind, "'always seems enveloped in a doubtful atmosphere, "'which is luminous or otherwise, "'according as my remembrances of it are sad or joyous. "'So young!' said Albert, forgetting at the moment the Count's command that he should ask no questions of the slave herself. "'Is it possible that you can have known what suffering is except by name?' Aidé turned her eyes towards Monte Cristo, who, making at the same time some imperceptible sign, murmured, "'Go on.' "'Nothing is ever so firmly impressed on the mind as the memory of our early childhood.' And with the exception of the two scenes I have just described to you, all my earliest reminiscences are fraught with deepest sadness. Speak, speak, Signora, said Albert. I am listening with the most intense delight and interest to all you say. Aidé answered his remark with a melancholy smile. You wish me, then, to relate the history of my past sorrows, said she. I beg of you to do so. "'Replied Albert. "'Well, I was but 4 years old "'when one night I was suddenly awoke by my mother. "'We were in the palace of Janina. "'She snatched me from the cushions on which I was sleeping, "'and on opening my eyes I saw hers were filled with tears. "'She took me away without speaking. "'When I saw her weeping, I began to cry too. "'Silence, child,' said she. At other times, in spite of maternal endearments or threats, I had, with a child's caprice, been accustomed to indulge my feelings of sorrow or anger by crying as much as I felt inclined. But on this occasion there was an intonation of such extreme terror in my mother's voice when she enjoined me to silence, that I ceased crying as soon as her command was given. She bore me rapidly away. I saw then that we were descending a large staircase. Around us were all my mother's servants, carrying trunks, bags, ornaments, jewels, purses of gold, with which they were hurrying away in the greatest distraction. Behind the women came a guard of 20 men, armed with long guns and pistols, and dressed in the costume which the Greeks have assumed since they have again become a nation. You may imagine there was something startling and ominous, said Aidé, shaking her head and turning pale at the mere remembrance of the scene, in this long file of slaves and women, only half aroused from sleep, or at least so they appeared to me, who was myself scarcely awake. Here and there, on the walls of the staircase, were reflected gigantic shadows, which trembled in the flickering light of the pine torches till they seemed to reach to the vaulted roof above. "Quick!" said a voice at the end of the gallery. This voice made everyone bow before it, resembling in its effect the wind passing over a field of corn, by its superior strength forcing every ear to yield obeisance. As for me, it made me tremble. This voice was that of my father. He marched the last, clothed in his splendid robes, and holding in his hand the carbine with which your emperor presented him. He was leaning on the shoulder of his favorite Selim, and he drove us all before him as a shepherd would his straggling flock. "'My father,' said Aidé, raising her head, "'was that illustrious man known in Europe under the name of Ali Tebelen, Pasha of Njanina, and before whom Turkey trembled. Albert, without knowing why, started on hearing these words pronounced with such a haughty and dignified accent. It appeared to him as if there was something supernaturally gloomy and terrible in the expression which gleamed from the brilliant eyes of Aidé at this moment.
She appeared like a pythoness evoking a spectre as she recalled to his mind the remembrance of the fearful death of this man, to the news of which all Europe had listened with horror. "Soon," said Ade, "we halted on our march and found ourselves on the borders of a lake. My mother pressed me to her throbbing heart, and at the distance of a few paces I saw my father, who was glancing anxiously around. 4 marble steps led down to the water's edge, and below them was a boat floating on the tide. From where we stood I could see in the middle of the lake a large black mass. It was the kiosk to which we were going. This kiosk appeared to me to be at a considerable distance, perhaps on account of the darkness of the night, which prevented any object from being more than partially discerned. We stepped into the boat. I remember well that the oars made no noise whatever in striking the water, and when I leaned over to ascertain the cause, I saw they were muffled with the sashes of our palikares. Besides the rowers, the boat contained only the women, my father, mother, Selim, and myself. The palikares had remained on the shore of the lake, ready to cover our retreat. They were kneeling on the lowest of the marble steps, and in that manner intended making a rampart of the 3 others in case of pursuit. Our bark flew before the wind. "Why does the boat go so fast?" asked I of my mother. "Silence, child. Hush. We are flying." I did not understand. Why should my father fly? He, the all-powerful, he before whom others were accustomed to fly, he who had taken for his device, "They hate me, then they fear me." It was indeed a flight which my father was trying to effect. I have been told since that the garrison of the castle of Yanina, fatigued with long service... Here Ade cast a significant glance at Monte Cristo, whose eyes had been riveted on her countenance during the whole course of her narrative. The young girl then continued, speaking slowly, like a person who is either inventing or suppressing some feature of the history which he is relating. "You were saying, Signora," said Albert, who was paying the most implicit attention to the recital, "that the garrison of Yanina, fatigued with long service, had treated with the Seraskier Khurshid, who had been sent by the Sultan to gain possession of the person of my father. It was then that Ali Tebelin took the resolution of retiring, after having sent to the Sultan a French officer in whom he reposed great confidence, to the asylum which he had long before prepared for himself, and which he called Cataphysion, or the Refuge." "And this officer," asked Albert, "do you remember his name, Signora?" Monte Cristo exchanged a rapid glance with the young girl, which was quite unperceived by Albert. "No," said she, "I do not remember it, just at this moment, but if it should occur to me presently, I will tell it you." Albert was on the point of pronouncing his father's name when Monte Cristo gently held up his finger in token of reproach. The young man recollected his vow and was silent. "It was towards this kiosk that we were rowing. A ground floor, ornamented with arabesques, bathing its terraces in the water, and another floor, looking on the lake, was all which was visible to the eye. But beneath the ground floor, stretching out into the island, was a large subterranean cavern to which my mother, myself, and the women were conducted. In this place were together 60,000 purses and 200 barrels. The purses contained 25 millions of money in gold, and the barrels were filled with 30,000 pounds of gunpowder. Near these barrels stood Selim, my father's favorite, whom I mentioned to you just now. It was his duty to watch day and night a lance, at the end of which was a lighted match, and he had orders to blow up all, kiosk, guards, women, gold, and Ali Tebelin himself, at the first signal given by my father.
I remember well that the slaves, convinced of the precarious tenure on which they held their lives, passed whole days and nights in praying, crying, and groaning. As for me, I can never forget the pale complexion and black eye of the young soldier, and whenever the angel of death summons me to another world, I am quite sure I shall recognize Salim. I cannot tell you how long we remained in this state. At that period I did not even know what time meant. Sometimes, but very rarely, my father summoned me and my mother to the terrace of the palace. These were my hours of recreation. I, who never saw anything in the dismal cavern but the gloomy countenances of the slaves and the fiery lance of Salim. My father was endeavouring to pierce with his eager looks the remotest verge of the horizon, examining attentively every black speck which appeared on the lake, whilst my mother, reclining by his side, rested her head on his shoulder, and I played at his feet, admiring everything I saw with that unsophisticated innocence of childhood which throws a charm round objects insignificant in themselves, but which, in its eyes, are invested with the greatest importance. The heights of Pindus towered above us. The castle of Yanina rose white and angular from the blue waters of the lake, and the immense masses of black vegetation which, viewed in the distance, gave the idea of lichens clinging to the rocks, were, in reality, gigantic fir trees and myrtles. One morning my father sent for us. My mother had been crying all the night and was very wretched. We found the Pasha calm, but paler than usual. "Take courage, Vasiliki," said he. "Today arrives the firman of the master, and my fate will be decided. If my pardon be complete, we shall return triumphant to Yanina. If the news be inauspicious, we must fly this night." "But supposing our enemy should not allow us to do so," said my mother. "Oh, make yourself easy on that head," said Ali, smiling. "Salim and his flaming lance will settle that matter. They would be glad to see me dead, but they would not like themselves to die with me." My mother only answered by sighs to these consolations, which she knew did not come from my father's heart. She prepared the iced water, which he was in the habit of constantly drinking, for, since his sojourn at the kiosk, he had been parched by the most violent fever, after which she anointed his white beard with perfumed oil and lighted his chibouk, which he sometimes smoked for hours together, quietly watching the wreaths of vapour, which, ascending in spiral clouds, gradually mixed itself with the surrounding atmosphere. Presently he made such a sudden movement that I was paralyzed with fear. Then, without taking his eyes from the object which had first attracted his attention, he asked for his telescope. My mother gave it him, and as she did so, looked whiter than the marble against which she leaned. I saw my father's hand tremble. "A boat, two, three," murmured my father, "four." He then rose, seizing his arms and priming his pistols. "Vasiliki," said he to my mother, trembling perceptibly, "the instant approaches which will decide everything. In the space of half an hour we shall know the Emperor's answer. Go into the cavern with Ade." "I will not quit you," said Vasiliki. "If you die, my lord, I will die with you." "Go to Salim," cried my father. "Adieu, my lord," murmured my mother, determining quietly to await the approach of death. "Take away Vasiliki," said my father to his palikares. As for me, I had been forgotten in the general confusion. I ran towards Ali Tebelin. He saw me hold out my arms to him, and he stooped down and pressed my forehead with his lips. Oh, how distinctly I remember that kiss! It was the last he ever gave me, and I feel as if it were still warm on my forehead. On descending, we distinguished through the latticework several boats which were gradually becoming more distinct to our view.
At first they appeared like black specks, and now they looked like birds skimming the surface of the waves. During this time, in the kiosk, at the feet of my father, were seated 20 Palikaris, concealed from view by an angle of the wall, and watching with eager eyes the arrival of the boats. They were armed with their long guns, inlaid with mother-of-pearl and silver, and cartouches in great numbers were lying scattered on the floor. My father looked at his watch and paced up and down with a countenance expressive of the greatest anguish. This was the scene which presented itself to my view when I quitted my father after that last kiss. My mother and I traversed the gloomy passage leading to the cavern. Salim was still at his post and smiled sadly on us as we entered. We fetched our cushions from the other end of the cavern and sat down by Salim. In great dangers the devoted ones cling to each other, and young as I was, I quite understood that some imminent danger was hanging over our heads. Albert had often heard, not from his father, for he never spoke on the subject, but from strangers, the description of the last moments of the vizier of Yanina. He had read different accounts of his death, but this history seemed to borrow new life from the voice and expression of the young girl. The living accent and the melancholy expression of countenance at once charmed and horrified him. As to Ade, these terrible reminiscences seemed to have overpowered her for the moment, for she ceased speaking, her head leaning on her hand like a beautiful flower bowing beneath the violence of the storm, and her eyes, gazing on vacancy, indicated that she was mentally contemplating the green summit of the Pindus and the blue waters of the lake of Yanina, which, like a magic mirror, seemed to reflect the somber picture which she sketched. Monte Cristo looked at her with an indescribable expression of interest and pity. "Go on," said the Count, in the Romaic language. Ade looked up abruptly, as if the sonorous tones of Monte Cristo's voice had awakened her from a dream, and she resumed her narrative. "It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and although the day was brilliant out of doors, we were enveloped in the gloomy darkness of the cavern. One single solitary light was burning there, and it appeared like a star set in a heaven of blackness. It was Salim's flaming lance. My mother was a Christian, and she prayed." Salim repeated from time to time these sacred words, "God is great." However, my mother had still some hope. As she was coming down, she thought she recognized the French officer who had been sent to Constantinople and in whom my father placed so much confidence, for he knew that all the soldiers of the French emperor were naturally noble and generous. She advanced some steps towards the staircase and listened. "They are approaching," said she. "Perhaps they bring us peace and liberty." "What do you fear, Vasiliki?" said Salim, in a voice at once so gentle and yet so proud. "If they do not bring us peace, we will give them war. If they do not bring life, we will give them death." And he renewed the flame of his lance with an alacrity which reminded one of the Dionysian festivals among the ancient Cretans. But I, who was only a little child, was terrified by this undaunted courage, which appeared to me both ferocious and senseless, and I recoiled with horror from the idea of the frightful death amidst fire and flame which probably awaited us. My mother experienced the same sensations, for I felt her tremble. "Mama, Mama," said I, "are we really to be killed?" And at the sound of my voice, the slaves redoubled their cries and prayers and lamentations. "My child," said Vasiliki, "may God preserve you from ever wishing for that death which today you so much dread." Then whispering to Salim, she asked what were his master's orders. "If he send me his poniard, it will signify that the emperor's intentions are not favorable,
and I am to set fire to the powder. If, on the contrary, he send me his ring, it will be a sign that the emperor pardons him, and I extinguish the match and leave the magazine untouched. My friend, said my mother, when your master's order arrives, if it is the poniard which he sends, instead of dispatching us by that horrible death which we both so much dread, you will mercifully kill us with this same poniard, will you not?
Yes, Vasiliki, replied Selim tranquilly. Suddenly we heard loud cries. We listened. They were cries of joy. The name of the French officer who had been sent to Constantinople resounded on all sides amongst our palikares. It was evident that he brought the answer of the emperor, and that it was favourable.
And do you not remember the Frenchman's name? Said Morcerf, quite ready to aid the memory of the narrator. Monte Cristo made a sign to him to be silent.
I do not recollect it, said Aide. The noise increased. Steps were heard approaching nearer and nearer. They were descending the steps leading to the cavern. Selim made ready his lance. Soon a figure appeared in the grey twilight at the entrance of the cave, formed by the reflection of the few rays of daylight which had found their way into this gloomy retreat.
"Who are you?" cried Selim. "But whoever you may be, I charge you not to advance another step."
"Long live the Emperor," said the figure. "He grants a full pardon to the Vizier Ali, and not only gives him his life, but restores to him his fortune and his possessions." My mother uttered a cry of joy and clasped me to her bosom.
"Stop," said Selim, seeing that she was about to go out. "You see, I have not yet received the ring."
"True," said my mother, and she fell on her knees, at the same time holding me up towards heaven, as if she desired, whilst praying to God in my behalf, to raise me actually to his presence.
And for the second time, Aide stopped, overcome by such violent emotion that the perspiration stood upon her pale brow, and her stifled voice seemed hardly able to find utterance, so parched and dry were her throat and lips. Monte Cristo poured a little iced water into a glass and presented it to her, saying, with a mildness in which was also a shade of command, "Courage." Aide dried her eyes and continued,
"By this time our eyes, habituated to the darkness, had recognized the messenger of the Pasha. It was a friend. Selim had also recognized him, but the brave young man only acknowledged one duty, which was to obey.
"In whose name do you come?" said he to him.
"I come in the name of our master, Ali Tebelin."
"If you come from Ali himself," said Selim, "you know what you are charged to remit to me."
"Yes," said the messenger, "and I bring you his ring."
At these words, he raised his hand above his head to show the token, but it was too far off, and there was not light enough to enable Selim, where he was standing, to distinguish and recognize the object presented to his view.
"I do not see what you have in your hand," said Selim.
"Approach then," said the messenger, "or I will come nearer to you, if you prefer it."
"I will agree to neither one nor the other," replied the young soldier. "Place the object which I desire to see in the ray of light which shines there, and retire whilst I examine it."
"Be it so," said the envoy, and he retired after having first deposited the token agreed on in the place pointed out to him by Selim. Oh, how our hearts palpitated, for it did indeed seem to be a ring which was placed there. But was it my father's ring? That was the question. Selim, still holding in his hand the lighted match, walked towards the opening in the cavern, and, aided by the faint light which streamed in through the mouth of the cave, picked up the token.
"It is well," said he, kissing it. "It is my master's ring." And throwing the match on the ground, he trampled on it and extinguished it. The messenger uttered a cry of joy and clapped his hands. At this signal, four soldiers of the Seraski of Khurshid suddenly appeared, and Salim fell, pierced by five blows. Each man had stabbed him separately, and, intoxicated by their crime, though still pale with fear, they sought all over the cavern to discover if there was any fear of fire, after which they amused themselves by rolling on the bags of gold. At this moment, my mother seized me in her arms, and bounding lightly along numerous turnings and windings known only to ourselves, she arrived at a private staircase.